This episode of Felon may contain disturbing content, including descriptions of violence and coarse language. Listener discretion is advised.
On the 13th of June, 2014, just after 5 a.m, Scott Collingwood, on a morning walk, not far from his home, made a disturbing discovery. At the base of an external set of stairs to a second floor apartment, lying on the ground was 25-year-old Michael Philip Martin. Michael was bound at the hands and feet and blindfolded with gaffer tape, struggling to move and crying out for help. Scott quickly approached and removed the tape. No longer bound, there came an emotional plea from Michael. "My dad's up there. They got my dad. I think he's dead." At 5:10 a.m, emergency operators were alerted of the incident by Scott, who quickly shared his discovery of Michael bound and seeking assistance. In the course of the operators' inquiries, Michael frantically added, "Sometime in the night, people came in and they grabbed me. I was sleeping. They took me out to the kitchen. And then, I don't know what they've done to Dad, but he's dead. He's friggin' dead." Police quickly made their way to the Quarry Road location in South Moolumbar. The scene waiting for them was horrific. Blood pooled on the floor surrounding the body of the victim, who had been identified by his son as Michael Martin Sr. During the course of the unfolding morning, Michael Jr. had made his way up the stairs and sobbed while grieving at the feet of his father on the floor. Michael Sr. had sustained extensive injuries from a bladed weapon, and the wounds appeared to have occurred in a rapid succession. A total of 16 wounds, one of which had penetrated his chest and pierced his heart. Another had left him almost decapitated. The attack had also inflicted slice and puncture wounds through his liver, kidney, ribs, face, and fingers. Still in a state of shock, Michael Martin Jr. shared his account of the events leading up to the attack with the investigating officers. On the 11th of June, 2 days prior to the attack, Michael Jr. had picked up his father from his father's ex-partner's home in the town of Biwa, near the Glasshouse Mountains region of Queensland. The pair had made an hour drive inland to the rural town of Esk in the southeast of Queensland. Michael Sr., often going by the name of Mick, had recently been discharged from hospital. Michael Jr. had taken it upon himself to assist his father in returning to his home to tidy it up from a recent incident that had put him in hospital. The pair stayed in the town of Esk at the family home of Michael Jr. before making a 2-hour drive south to the northern New South Wales town of Moolumbar, where Mick resided. The plan was to get some dinner and then make their way to Mick's home to clean it, as Mick was required to vacate the premises soon due to it being sold. The pair checked into a hotel in town, had dinner and a few beers at the Riverview Hotel, where Mick was a regular patron. Following dinner and drinks, they then made their way to the Quarry Road flat in South Moolumbar to begin the cleanup. The flat was one of two units on the second floor of a printing company located on the outskirts of town in an industrial area. According to Michael, they had not intended to stay at the unit, but after a few more drinks, they end up losing track of time and decide to sleep the night rather than returning to the hotel they had booked. Somewhere between 10 and 11 p.m., Mick retired to his bed and Michael rolled out a swag to sleep on the floor. At approximately 3 a.m. on the morning of the 13th of June, Michael Jr. was woken to a sharp blow to the head from an unknown intruder. He was dragged by his feet, bound with gaffer tape, and then strapped to a chair. He stated of the incident, "I got dragged by the feet out to the kitchen area. That's where I got bound by tape, and around my hands, my feet, and my face, I got told, 'Shut up or you die.' Held captive by what seemed to be two assailants wearing balaclavas, he was forced to sit helplessly while his father was repeatedly cut and stabbed to death. He described hearing a gurgling sound, which he had feared at the time was his father's throat being cut. The attackers, choosing to spare Michael's life, fled as quickly as they had arrived. Over the next 2 hours, he worked to free himself from the chair before rolling down the stairs of the apartment block, screaming for help, until being assisted by a passerby. News of the killing spread to the community, and the media shared the disturbing details, with Michael Jr. fronting the cameras to share his loss and making a public plea to viewers to assist in the search and capture of these dangerous individuals.
It was just terrifying. I'd never expected that I'd see my wife or children again. Anyone that can do that to someone, you know, they shouldn't be in our public streets. My father did have a colourful past, but he didn't deserve that.
In a heartfelt statement to the media, Michael continued, "I was asleep when I got hit and taped up while I was in the kitchen, and all I can remember is hearing the death of my father. It's not victimless here. My father did have a colourful past, but he didn't deserve that, and the innocent family members don't deserve it. We were just trying to get him a new start and get him wherever we could, and unfortunately, we'll never know." From the public eye, and possibly even the view of police, it seemed that what Michael referred to as a colourful past, which had included an involvement with drugs, may have caught up with his father. Mick also had the reputation of getting into fights and regularly sported black eyes from these. To those who knew him around his local haunts, he was affectionately called Mullet Mick due to his choice of hairstyle. He was loud in his interactions, and while he didn't appear to have any serious enemies, he would often find himself in confrontations, both verbal and physical. In one such altercation in 2010, 4 years prior, he'd been slashed by a beer glass to the face, which had required a significant amount of stitches. It was also not the first time that Mick had been a victim of a violent assault in his home. 2 months prior to the murder, on the 7th of April 2014, Mick had been asleep in the same address when at around 3 a.m, three intruders had entered and used a knife and a sledgehammer to viciously attack him and his friend, Edmund Manning, who was also living at the premises at the time. This attack had left his home ransacked and covered in blood. During this first assault, Mick received a stab wound to his left eye, resulting in permanent loss of vision, 2 collapsed lungs, a stab wound to the neck, and multiple fractures to the face. So great were his injuries that he was required to be placed on life support in order to recover from the attack. During his time in hospital, complications led to a medical condition referred to as dead bowel, accompanied by a potential renal failure, septic shock, and the need for dialysis. He was required to remain in intensive care for a month and would remain in hospital for a second month before continuing his recovery under the care of his ex-partner until the 11th of June, when he was picked up by his son, Michael Jr., prior to the second attack. Edmund Manning's injuries were also extensive. He received a fractured collarbone, fractured ribs, nose and face. He also suffered a collapsed lung, and part of his ear had been cut off. Edmund had also required life support for 4 days and was in a coma for 6. During his time in hospital, Edmund lost 20 kilograms and without emergency care would have most likely have succumbed to his injuries. Edmund suffered ongoing symptoms of post-traumatic disorder, which included a suspicion of strangers and a fear of crowds and public spaces. Both assaults on Mick had been extremely brutal in nature, and it seemed to authorities that he had made some dangerous enemies. With the prospect of multiple violent killers on the loose, police quickly got to work, following up any leads they could. A strike force titled ERAE, which was a joint operation between the State Crime Command's Homicide Squad and Tweed Byron and Local Area Command, was established to investigate the slaying. As part of the investigation, an image of a late 1980s or early 1990 Camry sedan was released with part of the registration, with the hope a member of the public may be able to assist police with their inquiries. They indicated that the car could be linked to both home invasions and hadn't ruled out that the same offenders could potentially be linked to both attacks. The crime scene was difficult for forensic investigators to navigate. Not only was there an extreme amount of blood, but there were also previous dried blood samples from the night of the first home invasion. It was described as one crime scene overlapping another. An autopsy indicated that the cut and stab wounds were likely caused by a long sword rather than a knife, which had been used repeatedly in a swift slicing and stabbing motion. There was also an axe left at the scene, which appeared to also have been used at some point in the attack. Time passed, and investigators had worked through a range of possible leads and suspicions, but by the end of 2014, they were yet to make an arrest. Late in February, of 2015, the news of an arrest in relation to the first attack on Mick filled the local headlines. It seemed hopeful that through the arrest of this individual, detectives could gain more insight into the second fatal attack. On Tuesday, the 24th of February, 21-year-old Jessica Honey Fallon, a sex worker from Byron Bay, was arrested and charged with attempted murder and assault, occasioning grievous bodily harm for the role that police claim she played in the attack. Acting on a series of discoveries, police alleged that Jessica had been part of a trio armed with a knife and a sledgehammer who had forced their way into the flat of Mick and Edmund, subjecting both occupants to a savage assault. Jessica confessed to police that she collaborated with two male individuals that she referred to only as Blue and White. During a lengthy interrogation that played out in the Lismore District Court, Jessica recounted meeting with a man called Blue at Mwilumbah's Roadhouse Tavern 3 weeks prior to the incident. She claimed that he offered her $25,000 to beat up a man named Mick as a warning. It was documented that throughout the interview, Jessica's demeanor was erratic with frequent mumbling, fidgeting, and inconsistencies in her story. She admitted to being under the influence of drugs during the invasion and estimated that she had spent thousands of dollars on ice in the weeks leading up to it. Despite her shaky recollection and drug-induced state, Jessica confessed to her involvement in the crime. As part of her confession, she disclosed that accompanied by a man referred to as Blue, she retrieved an arsenal of weapons, including knives, guns, and balaclavas, from a location in Brisbane. Their journey continued as they headed to Mwilumbah with a detour to Palm Beach on the Gold Coast to pick up the man known as White. Arriving at Mick's home in Mwilumbah in the early hours of the 7th of April, Jessica described being the first to enter. As Mick answered the door, she allegedly stabbed him in the neck and in the eye. The scene quickly descended into further brutality as Mick fell to the ground, injured. Jessica claimed that they proceeded to restrain him, while the two men, Blue and White, inflicted further violence, which included stripping him of his pants and then continuing the assault. In a disturbing account, Jessica continued and detailed that she heard the sounds of bones breaking and the popping noises associated with the stabbing. She admitted to believing Mick was dead after the onslaught. As the situation spiraled out of control, with Edmund Manning waking up, Jessica claimed that she was instructed to leave and made her way downstairs. Following their departure from the flat, she stated that the three of them disposed of the knives in the Tweed River before seeking refuge in a nearby residence. It was here that they showered, incinerated their bloodstained clothes, and later discarded the firearms. Jessica admitted to receiving $25,000 for her involvement that she claimed to have stashed in her mother's Byron Bay home. During a follow-up search of the property, authorities were unable to locate the proceeds of the crime. With these detailed confessions, Jessica was held in custody and refused bail while awaiting a trial. In a strange turn of events, despite a seemingly detailed knowledge of the crime, it was later concluded in court that she had played no part in the assault at all. The charges against Jessica were dropped when compelling evidence emerged, proving that there was no way that she could be in Mick's residence in South Mwilumbah during the invasion. It was suggested Jessica's drug use and state of mind made her vulnerable to being coerced into a confession. During her trial, Jessica's defense lawyer claimed, "In my submission, this is a weak Crown case." She went on to point out instances where investigating officers had allegedly provided Jessica with information that she had later echoed. She also made note of the absence of crucial evidence, such as CCTV footage, DNA samples, or fingerprints placing Jessica at the scene. Additionally, she reminded the court that the victims, Mick and Edmund, had described the intruders as males, further casting doubt on Jessica's involvement. It was also determined that despite a seemingly intimate knowledge of the crime scene and the events leading up to and following the attack, Jessica was in fact on a bus from Sydney to Queensland at the time of the vicious assault. After remaining for a lengthy stint in custody, now with no evidence against her, Jessica Fallon was cleared of any charges and was free to go. Soon after Jessica Fallon was initially taken into custody, the focus of the investigation had turned closer to home. With the mention of the involvement of two male offenders in both attacks, police set their sights on those who they felt stood to gain from the death of Mick. In the days following the murder of his father, Michael had given multiple statements of the incident to police and had fronted the media cameras in a plea for assistance in the capture of those who had robbed him of his father and his children of a grandfather. He painted a picture of a man who had faults, but regardless was loved by him and his family. What Michael had not mentioned was up until around 2 months prior to the first attack, the two had not been on good terms for a number of years, with Michael choosing to block him out of his life. It was Michael's opinion that Mick had not been a good father and viewed his upbringing at Mick's hand to be abusive. In a documentary titled Today's Cowboys, a young Michael Martin, as a subject for an interview, was vocal in his opinion of his father, describing what led him to turn his back on his father years prior.
I'll never become something like that. Child abusing, bloody women raping bastard. Yeah, no, be buggered if I ever do that. Yeah, no. I shook his hand and I said, look what you become, you fat slob. I said, I'm becoming something. I said, well, you can sit here and think you're good. I said, I'm going to make a life for myself. That was the last time I saw him. I said, we'll catch you later. I walked in, never seen him again. Never will either, I don't reckon. Hey.
The voicing of his opinion in the interview was not damning in the eyes of investigators, but it offered a valuable insight into the relationship between Michael Jr. and Sr. and led them to inquire what had prompted a shift in recent times. Another factor that had caught their interest was that 2 days after appearing to the media for the first time, Michael had contacted the local police requesting documentation. This request came as part of a life insurance policy claim for his father. It was soon revealed that a total of 3 life insurance policies had been taken out for Mick in the months prior to the pair reconnecting. On the 2nd, 3rd and 21st of February of 2014, Michael took out 3 insurance policies over his father's life. 2 of the policies had a combined value of $1.5 million and would benefit the estate of Michael Martin Sr., of which Michael Jr. would receive a third, with the remaining portion being allocated to Mick's 2 younger children. The third policy was taken out to the amount of $1 million and would benefit only Michael Martin Jr. The combined value of these policies came to a total of $2.5 million. Michael Jr. had experienced a turbulent life as a child. His father's alcohol and substance abuse had a significant effect on his parenting approach. Both authorities and family members had been witness to this. Despite his upbringing, Michael had worked hard and graduated with an engineering degree. At the time of the attack on his father, Michael had a job as a civil engineer at Somerset Regional Council. Despite having a decent wage, being the sole provider for his family of 5, and with his children requiring specialized medical treatment, the family finances had been stretched. A $27,000 debt had accumulated on credit cards, with a significant amount owing on a mortgage. Money was tight, and both Michael and his wife Candace were under increasing pressure to stay afloat. With this knowledge, the detectives had maintained a close eye on Michael's movements. On the 15th of March, 2015, 9 months following the brutal slaying of his father, Michael was again called in to the Tweed Heads police station.
Michael, you're not free to go from the police station anymore.
Really? Okay. What's going on?
At this stage, we're going to place you under arrest.
Oh, fuck off.
For the murder of your father.
No.
Fuck off. Okay. You don't have to say anything you don't want to, but anything you say can be used in evidence. Do you understand that?
What's going on?
As part of this interview, Michael, upon hearing the news of his arrest, reiterated his versions of the events in which he himself was attacked and made a desperate attempt to plead his innocence.
So, obviously, Dad and I got down to Wollumbah that afternoon. Mm-hmm. Dad's place was still in shambles from the previous attack.
Yeah.
Blood everywhere and all the rest. We had to move him out because the place was being sold. So we went down to the Riverview Hotel to get some dinner.
Yeah.
We got some dinner. We got a couple of beers, went back and started packing up the place. About 10-11 o'clock, we went to sleep.
Mm-hmm.
Dad went to sleep on the bed and I went to sleep on my swag, which was on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
During early hours of the morning,
mm-hmm.
I got woken up and got hit to the left-hand side of the head.
Yeah.
I got hit. Mm-hmm. I got dragged by the feet out into the kitchen area.
Mm-hmm.
That's where I got bound by tape and around my hands, my feet and my face.
Yep.
You know, I'm on the ground looking up, right?
Yep.
Hands over my head because it hurt and I nearly got knocked down. They tape me feet up and then they're going, grab me hands, going like that, tape me hands up like that, and then going around the face. Around like here and a little bit over the eyelids.
Sorry, so they taped your hands first?
I believe it was me feet, my hands, me face.
Okay, so you hands second?
Believe so. And then me face.
So how did you not see these people?
Well, I didn't see what they were wearing. Like, they had gloves and they had a balaclava, like a face covering on. I didn't see.
Okay.
Yeah.
So what did the balaclava look like?
Like a balaclava does, black balaclava, you know, like.
Like, there's different types.
You know, like the holes? You know,
the single hole,
yeah.
Half face.
Just single holes.
Yeah.
And how many people are there?
Well, two. I believe two. I saw one, but I believe two. You gotta remember, I wasn't like fully awake, and they did hit me when I was asleep. You know, and I was pretty dazed and out of it. Like, I wasn't exactly looking around all awake, you know.
Yeah.
I was just focusing on like that, you know. There's the people there. There's one person there. I run back upstairs and saw Dad's body.
Yeah.
You know, with the blood everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the honest truth.
Yeah.
That is the honest truth.
Yeah.
You know, I bawled at Dad's feet.
Yeah.
That is honest God truth.
Yeah.
That is what happened that night.
A burning question in a few people's minds. If your dad was so horrible to you when you were a child, why are you so upset?
Because, like, I'd spent months with Dad by his side, you know, just... Yeah, as weird as it is, a fatherly bond, father and son bond. Yes, Dad had done cruel things to me, but, you know, crazy it is, I still loved him. He was still my dad.
Did you have anything to do with the organisation of the home invasion in April?
No way. No, not 100% no. I was at home. We were in bed. Mm-hmm. You know? There is no way I organised that.
Do you know the people who committed the murder?
No. I would tell you, I would honest to God tell you guys, because this has not affected just me. This is my family. I lost my wife in this. No, definitely not.
Despite his apparent shock, Michael was required to remain in custody to await trial. A month prior to this arrest, Michael's wife Candace had left him. The strain of the financial burden and ongoing investigation had taken its toll on the relationship. On the 2nd of March, as an attempt to reconcile with her, Michael had penned a letter titled, "Dearest Candace," a copy of which Michael kept in a drawer of his office at work. Throughout this letter, he outlined his feelings for her and continued to elaborate on where he felt things started to break down. While in custody, a recorded phone call to Candace indicated that Michael held concerns for the contents of the letter, and he asked Candace to retrieve it from his office. With the assumption that their communication would be monitored, he referred to the letter to Candace as a psychiatrist referral, and he hinted that she had seen it before and stressed the importance of collecting it a number of times. The following is a recreation of that call.
Nah, it's all right. Just, yeah, I know I want to get home. Yeah, so did you get that letter from work?
What letter?
The psychiatric letter.
Oh, no, I haven't. I'll get that for you.
Can you make sure, like, even today?
Yeah, okay, all right.
Get, like, going to my third drawer.
Yep.
Where are you now?
At home. I'll get it just before I pick up Ollie, if that's okay.
Yeah, just ask the girls if you can just duck into my office.
Yep.
And it's in the third drawer. Yeah, if you could do that, like, immediately. But, yeah, I need to.
Yeah, okay, you need to cancel it?
Yeah, just a psychiatric referral that should be.
Aha, uh-huh. Right.
So it's about six pages long. You'll know it when you see it.
Right. Just.
You've seen it once before, so.
Yeah, I have. Just the police might have it, that's all.
Did they go to work?
Because they did.
Can you go and have a look?
Yeah, I will. I promise I will.
Later that day, there's a further telephone conversation in which Michael asked Candace, "So you haven't been to work yet?" To which she replied, "No, not yet." On the 3rd of April 2015, there was another call in which Michael asked Candace whether she'd been to his work yet. And she replied, "I did. It's not there." In a follow-up conversation, when asked again by Michael about the letter, Candace shared that the police had stopped by his office and it appeared that they may have it in their possession. Police had in fact seized the letter, and it proved to be a vital part of evidence in building a case against Michael, and it would soon be revealed why he held such concern about it falling into their hands. After detailing his ongoing love for Candace and reminiscing about their past, Michael reflected on his dysfunctional childhood and the suicide attempts he had made. In the closing paragraphs, he outlined details of events and emotions surrounding the murder of his father.
Money got tighter and we had another bright idea to free our lives up more. I wouldn't have to work so hard and therefore worry less. You and I would finally be able to have the things in life we ever wanted. Plans were set and everything seemed perfect. Our biggest problem is that we are too good at heart. Our guilt has stuck since the moment we concocted our bright idea. Looking back, if I could have seen the ramifications on our marriage, there is no way I would have considered it. But again, I have to live with my choices. After that trip to Nana and Pa's and that night thereafter, I feel so guilty, but not for what happened, but for the way I let myself lose control. 25 years of torture from these people led me to do the unthinkable. I let myself lose control and it scared me. Not at what I did, but the mere fact that the animal side got the better of me. I know for a fact that I can control myself every other time, but for those few minutes, I let my emotions control everything I did and the result could be seen. I was a very hurt man who had been hurt by the very person who should have loved me the most but caused me so much pain. I guess it was my guilt that caused me to be at the hospital so much. I was guilty because every time I entered that room, I saw what I had done, what my raw emotion had done, and it hurt me so much. I guess it was the main reason I tried so hard to finish it then, to put the man that had taken the full brunt of my animal side out of pain, but he was too strong, a pig-headed bastard like me. But after he came out of that coma, I thought to myself that I would let him go on and lead a somewhat normal existence. I would even help him make a new start. Maybe I could even make him impress his mother. Wow, imagine if I could do that. But then the bitch got involved and got him out of hospital too early. I knew it wouldn't last. Once she found out she couldn't get money out of him, then she was through with him. And the only person who was left to pick up the pieces was me. And how cruel of me to get you and the kids to have to deal with such a big burden because of me. The trip home from Birwa made me realize one thing. Nothing I or anyone else in this world could ever make this man change. He spoke with such bitterness and anger about everything, including his own mother. I thought maybe I could get him back to hospital, maybe get him to rent an apartment somewhere near the coast and leave him be. I could see him occasionally, but wouldn't have to have too much to do with him. And then I realized how scared he made you. How could I ask this of my wife, the one person who gave me life and was the reason I wanted to live and succeed? And at that time, all I could give her was fear because of what I had done. It wasn't your fear but mine that caused me to come up with the solution I did. On that trip down to New South Wales, I knew what was coming but spoke to Dad as if everything were fine. That one trip revealed a lot to me about my father, but through everything, the most evident was that this Shell was a good man gone too far bad. He hated everything about himself, everyone else, and just the world. He told me that he just wished he died in hospital so he didn't have to be in pain, not physical anymore. I had a choice that night. I could have quite easily packed up and brought him home, but I wanted to ease his pain. But was that my place? I now know it wasn't, but I felt at the time that I had caused every bit of his pain for the last 25 years, so I carried through with my plan. As I said, I'm too good a person to be professional and let that demon be released again. I can't explain how scared that makes me, and from that morning on, I vowed to never let myself lose control ever again. And to my dying day, no one will ever see that again. I certainly haven't handled things well thereon. I didn't want to traumatize you with my own issues about that night, so thought that working and putting it at the back of my mind was better. Unfortunately, I now see that you and the children have been hurt in that process and how selfish of me to do that to you guys. I wish I had better strategies to cope with things, and I think with help from Rhonda, my new psychiatrist, and regardless of us, a relationship specialist, I think I will be able to improve myself dramatically. I am truly sorry I have hurt you through this whole disaster, but I don't regret you and I. The only part I regret is the poor choices I have made.
In the hands of police, the letter revealed disturbing information about the possibility of Michael's involvement in the murder of his father. This, along with the recorded phone call between Michael and Candace, also offered an insight into Candace's knowledge of the event. With Michael in custody, police turned their sights on Candace. On the 2nd of March, after receiving the letter from Michael, Candace had sent him a text message stating the following.
I got your letter and read it. I can't. Too much to deal with. Life needs to be more simple. You may see it as running. It's not. It's self-preserving. I can't let into my head or heart again. I have put it behind me. You are right, our love is deep but has destroyed me. I have picked up the pieces. I would rather be with a person who barely scratches the surface than someone who can hurt me so deeply. I ultimately just want to be alone. Kids need me, they are our everything. I have hurt you and I am so sorry. I can't trust you or anyone not to hurt me again. I won't give anyone that power.
This confirmed to authorities that Candace had in fact read it and was aware of its contents. On the 8th of April 2015, a month after her husband's arrest, Candace was recorded by investigators making a number of confessions. These included assisting her husband, lying to police about the murder, and knowing the location of where the murder weapon had been disposed. On the 9th of April, following these admissions, Candace was also arrested and charged with being an accessory to murder. While in custody in the Brisbane Watch House, Candace was secretly recorded stating,
wrote me a letter and the police found it. It was pretty much a written confession.
She was also recorded in a conversation with an undercover police officer who quizzed her about investigators having anything against her husband. Candace replied,
"That letter. And now me."
With both Candace and Michael in custody, investigators continued to build their case for their trial. Relying on statements from Candace, both voluntarily offered and secretly recorded, and also evidence that they had collected throughout the investigation, police pieced together the events that led to the murder of Michael Martin Sr. On Sunday, the 15th of December, 2013, Michael Martin Jr. confided in his wife with a chilling proposition. He allegedly suggested a plan that could help take care of their financial struggles, stating, "I could take out an insurance policy out of my father and take him out. I would feel no remorse in taking that piece of shit out of the world." Over the 2nd, 3rd and 21st of February of 2014, three life insurance policies were taken out in Michael Martin Sr.'s name, with OnePath, Clearview Wealth and Zurich, of which totaled $2.5 million. On the 6th of April 2014, Michael and Candace, accompanied by their three children, travelled from their home in Esk to Mawillumbah for lunch with Michael's father, Mick. During the visit, Michael presented his father with a gift, a 5-litre bottle of homemade whiskey. They dropped Mick back at his flat with Edmund Manning and made their way back to Esk. Michael, knowing his father's weakness for alcohol, had allegedly left him with the bottle in the hope that Mick would be incapacitated later that evening. As they made their way back home, Michael stated to Candace, "I'm coming back for Dad tonight. Don't worry, it's all arranged." In the early hours of the following morning, Michael returned to Mawillumbah at approximately 3 a.m, possibly with assistance. Michael forced his way into his father's flat. Wearing a mask, he wielded a sledgehammer and attempted to kill his father and bash his father's friend and flatmate. Mick survived the attack, but sustained critical injuries, spending the next 8 weeks in hospital and undergoing rehabilitation. During his recovery in hospital, Michael spent hours at his bedside. It was alleged by Candace that at some point, Michael had injected Mick with a syringe containing a cocktail of blood, bile and feces. It was also Candace's claim that she had found putrid-smelling syringes filled with a fungal green-coloured liquid in Michael's sock drawer, just days after his father developed septicemia and had a cardiac arrest in hospital. Sometime early in May of 2014, the sledgehammer used in the first home invasion was burned, along with balaclavas, gloves and jerry cans. On the 11th of June, Mick, who had been discharged into the care of his ex-partner in Biwa, was picked up by Michael and taken to the Martin family home in Esk. The pair stayed the night and made their way back to Mawillumbah the following day, on the 12th of June, with the intention to clean up Mick's flat in preparation for its sale. Along the journey, the pair stopped to get fuel and also visited a Bunnings hardware store in Bouval, a suburb in the city of Ipswich. Michael went inside alone while Mick waited in the car. Police obtained the receipt of Michael's purchases, which documented a range of items, some of which could be dismissed as cleaning products for his father's flat, but others were more suspicious. The list included a 12-litre square plastic bucket, a 2-litre bottle of pine disinfectant, a pack of large latex gloves, two 25-metre lengths of outdoor rope, a 25-metre roll of black cloth tape, a dispenser of packing tape, and a 25-pack of surface wipes. On the evening of the 12th of June, following dinner and drinks at the Riverview Hotel, the pair purchased a carton of beer and made their way to Mick's flat to begin the cleanup. At around 3 a.m, it was alleged that Michael Jr. used a samurai sword to brutally kill his father, slashing and stabbing him 16 times. At some point, he removed the sword from the premises. He bound himself with cloth tape that he purchased at Bunnings and made his way down the stairs to seek assistance from a passerby in the hope to back his story of an attack on both of them by home invaders. Candace testified that she had witnessed Michael grind off the tip of a samurai sword in their garden shed soon after the murder. She also stated that the sword had a red sheeny stain along the blade. To dispose of the remaining portion of the sword, it was said to have been cut into pieces, dipped in acid, and then dumped in a Coles supermarket bag. A month following the death of his father, on the 15th of July, Michael Martin completed a claim form for one of the insurance policies. This document was signed by Michael, and his wife Candace signed as a witness. A month after completing this claim form, Michael contacted the local police in order to arrange documentation that would enable him to process what he downplayed as, quote, a little insurance claim. In September of 2014, Michael and Candace traveled to Fiji for a holiday. Both posed and smiled for photos, but this apparent happiness would be fleeting. The following year, their relationship had spiraled beyond repair, prompting Candace to send a text message that indicated she wanted to end the relationship. It was this message that prompted an emotional outpouring from Michael in the form of his Dearest Candace letter, a portion of which would incriminate him for the violent killing of his father when it was seized by police. The trial of Candace and Michael was emotional. Candace faced intense scrutiny from the prosecution, prompting dramatic responses from her on a number of occasions. Although pleading guilty to accessory to murder after the fact and grievous bodily harm with the intent to murder, she claimed that her motivation to do so was based on fear of her ex-husband and the safety of herself and her three children. To back these claims, Candace testified of violent incidents involving Michael, including an occasion when he threatened her with a knife, held a samurai sword to her throat, and taunted her with the severed head of a puppy. On the 3rd of November, 2017, Candace Martin was sentenced to 9 years with a no parole period of 4 years. Despite hearing of the neglect and abuse that his father Michael Martin Sr. inflicted on him growing up, the jury, when faced with the indisputable evidence against him, found Michael Philip Martin guilty of his crimes, and he was sentenced to a total of 37 years imprisonment with a non-parole period of 27 years and 9 months.
The judge called it a cold-blooded execution for money. A son who hacked his father to death with a samurai sword to cash in $2.5 million worth of life insurance policies. But it was not the first time Michael Martin Sr. had been viciously attacked by his son, who tonight is behind bars where he'll stay for up to 37 years.
It was just terrifying. I never expected that I'd see my wife or children again. Anyone that can do that to someone, you know, they shouldn't be in that public streets. My father did have a colourful past, but he didn't deserve that.
Felon, true crime,